Good morning. In just 10 days, the State Children's Health Insurance Program, known as SCHIP, is set to expire. This important program helps children whose families cannot afford private health insurance but do not qualify for Medicaid to get coverage they need. I have strongly supported SCHIP as a governor, and I have done so as president. My 2008 budget proposed to increase SCHIP funding by $5 billion over 5 years. It's a 20% increase over current levels of funding. Unfortunately, instead of working with the administration to enact this funding increase for children's health, Democrats in Congress have decided to pass a bill they know that will be vetoed. One of their leaders has even said such a veto would be, quote, a political victory. As if this weren't irresponsible enough, Congress is waiting until the SCHIP program is just about to expire before getting a final bill passed. In other words, members of Congress are putting health coverage for poor children at risk so they can score political points in Washington. The legislation would raise taxes on working people and would raise spending by between $35 to $50 billion. Their proposal would result in taking a program meant to help poor children and turning it into one that covers children in households with incomes of up to $83,000 a year. The proposal would move millions of American children who now have private health insurance into government-run health care. Our goal should be for children who have no health insurance to be able to get private coverage, not for children who already have private health insurance to be able to get government coverage. What I'm describing here is a philosophical divide that exists in Washington over the best approach for health care. Democratic leaders in Congress want to put more power in the hands of government by expanding federal health care programs. Their SCHIP plan is an incremental step toward the goal of government-run health care for every American. I have a different view. I believe the best approach is to put more power in the hands of individuals by empowering people and their doctors to make health care decisions that are right for them. Instead of expanding SCHIP beyond its original purpose, we should return it to its original focus, and that is helping poor children, those who are most in need. And instead of encouraging people to drop private coverage in favor of government plans, we should work to make basic private health insurance affordable and accessible for all Americans. My administration will continue working with Congress to pass a responsible SCHIP bill. In the meantime, Congress has an obligation to make sure health insurance for poor children does not lapse. If they fail to do so, more than 1 million children could lose health coverage. Health coverage for these children should not be held hostage while political ads are being made and new polls are being taken. Congress must pass a clean, temporary extension of the current SCHIP program that I can sign by September the 30th, and that's the date when the program expires. I've instructed Secretary of Health and Human Services Mike Leavitt, who has joined us today, to work with states on ways to mitigate the damage that would result if Congress allows this program to lapse. Our goal in passing legislation should be getting something done for those in need, not getting nothing done so politicians in Washington can claim a political victory. Mike Leavitt is going to answer questions, if you have any, after my press conference. You looked a little concerned as to whether or not I'd answer any questions. And now I'm happy to take any questions you have, starting with Terry.
Mr. President, economists say that the nation is at increasing risk of recession. What do you say?
I say that the fundamentals of our nation's economy are strong. Inflation's down. Job markets are steady and strong. For all that, national unemployment rate is 4.6%. Corporate profits appear to be strong. Exports are up. There is no question that there is some unsettling times in the housing market and credits associated with the housing market. And that's why I look forward to working with Congress to modernize the FHA loans so that people can refinance their homes, and to change the tax code so that if somebody renegotiates a loan, they don't have to pay a penalty, a tax penalty in so doing. I'm optimistic about our economy. I would be pessimistic, however, if the Congress has its way and raises taxes. I believe the worst thing that can happen now is to allow the Congress to do that which they have said they want to do, which is to raise the taxes on people. And because I think taking money out of the hands of investors and consumers and small business owners would weaken the economy. And so, as I say, I'm optimistic, but I would be pessimistic if I thought Congress was going to get their way, and they're not. They're not going to raise taxes.
Do you think there's a risk of a recession? How do you rate that?
You know, you need to talk to economists. I think I got a B in Econ 101. I got an A, however, in keeping taxes low and being fiscally responsible with the people's money. We've submitted a plan that will enable this budget to become balanced by 2012, so long as Congress learns to set priorities. And we can balance a budget without raising taxes. Karen.
Thank you. The French foreign minister has raised the possibility of war with Iran. Is there a risk that the escalating rhetoric over Iran could boost the chances of war? And what would be your message to the UN next week regarding Iran?
I have consistently stated that I'm hopeful that we can convince the Iranian regime to give up any ambitions it has in developing a weapons program and do so peacefully. And that ought to be the objective of any diplomacy. And to this end, we are working with allies and friends to send a consistent message to the Iranians that there is a better way forward for them than isolation, financial isolation, and or economic sanctions. I believe it's imperative that we continue to work in a multilateral fashion to send that message, and one place to do so is at the United Nations. We're also talking to different finance ministers about how we can send a message to the Iranian government that the free world is just not going to tolerate the development of know-how on how to build a weapon, or at least gain the ability to make a weapon. And the reason why is because it's very important for us to take the threats coming out of the mouth of the president of Iran very seriously. It's the person that is, you know, constantly talks about the use of force on Israel, for example, and Israel's our very firm and strong ally. I also, it's very important for the Iranian people to know that our the United States recognizes the grand tradition and history of Iran, and that we respect the people of Iran. We just believe that their government has made choices that make it difficult for them to realize their dreams, to realize their full potential. The Iranian economy is suffering, some of it through mismanagement, some of it as a result of international pressures. And the people of Iran have got to know that some of the suffering that they're having inside their country is caused by their government. It's inability to work with the world in a responsible way regarding, you know, their desire to enrich uranium. And so we'll keep the pressure on them. And again, the objective, of course, is to solve this peacefully. David, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Where have you been?
I've been around. Been around.
You've been doing those shows.
Sir, Israeli opposition leader Netanyahu has now spoken openly about Israel's bombing raid on a target in Syria earlier in the month. I wonder if you could tell us what the target was, whether you supported this bombing raid, and what do you think it does to change the dynamic in an already hot region in terms of Syria and Iran and the dispute with Israel, and whether the U.S. can be drawn into any of this?
I'm not going to comment on the matter. Would you like another question?
Did you support it?
I'm not going to comment on the matter.
Can you comment about your concerns that come out of it at all, about for the region?
No. saying I'm not going to comment on the matter means I'm not going to comment on the matter.
You're welcome to ask another question if you'd like to.
I'll ask
on a
you,
different subject.
I'll ask you about Iraq. Efforts to curtail the deployment of troops is an ongoing debate right now. One of the things you spoke about in your address last week had to do with impatience with the Iraqi government, and you spoke about that, but not in much detail. How is that dynamic changing, your level of frustration with the lack of political progress, and how long can Americans reasonably expect you to wait before you take some kind of action that really forces the Iraqi government's hand to reach the goals of reconciliation that you set for them?
In my speech, I made it clear that there has to be a change in security for there to be reconciliation. And I also said that progress will yield fewer troops. In other words, return on success. That's what I said. There are two types of reconciliation, David. One is that reconciliation, that very visible reconciliation that happens through the passage of law. In other words, it's reconciliation that shows the Iraqi people that people from different backgrounds can get along, and at the same time that government can function. Clearly, there needs to be work there. In other words, there needs to be the passage of law. For example, we strongly believe that an oil revenue sharing law will send a message to Sunni, Shia, and Kurd alike that there is an effort at the national level to achieve reconciliation. Having said that, however, there is a functioning government. And the reason I bring, I guess my point is this, that in spite of the fact they haven't passed the law, there is the sharing of oil revenues on a relatively equitable basis. The other, and so we'll continue to work with the government to insist and impress upon them the need for there to be the passage of law, whether it be provincial election laws or debathification law or the oil law. There is local reconciliation taking place. I had a fascinating conversation in the Roosevelt Room earlier this week with members of provincial reconstruction teams from around Iraq who talked about how, you know, people are sick and tired of murder and violence, and that they expect their local governments and their central government to be more responsive to their needs, and local governments are beginning to respond. Part of the reason why there's not this kind of instant democracy in Iraq is because people are still recovering from Saddam Hussein's brutal rule. I thought an interesting comment was made when somebody said to me, I heard somebody say, you know, where's Mandela? Well, Mandela's dead because Saddam Hussein killed all the Mandelas. He was a brutal tyrant that divided people up and split families, and people are recovering from this. So there's a psychological recovery that is taking place, and it's hard work for him, and I understand it's hard work for him. Having said that, I'm not going to give him a pass when it comes to the central government's reconciliation efforts. I also said in my speech, local politics will drive national politics, and I believe that. I believe as more reconciliation takes place at the local level, you'll see a more responsive central government. Yes.
Axelrod. Thank you, Mr. President. Your Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, was recently asked by New York Times columnist David Brooks if knowing what he knows now, invading Iraq was a good idea. And I believe your Defense Secretary answered, I don't know. Does that represent daylight with you? Is that second guessing? Have you spoken to the Defense Secretary? And has that changed your mind at all?
I think he made it pretty clear the removal of Saddam, I don't know about this column, but I know his previous statements, he said getting rid of Saddam Hussein was the right decision. But I haven't talked to him about the column. If I had to ask everybody in my government to respond to columns and news stories, that's all I'd be doing, is talking to people in my government. I am absolutely convinced Secretary Gates knows that removing Saddam was the right thing, and I'm absolutely convinced he believes we will succeed in Iraq. I've got a lot of trust in the man. He's doing a fine job as the secretary. Martha.
You won't comment on what the Israelis may or may not have done.
That's an accurate statement. I hope you got the result of my answer. Now you're afraid, yeah. Of course, now Gregory's worried I'm actually going to comment, see.
That's what I'm hoping.
I'm not going to, so you might want to go to another subject.
I don't want to comment on that, but let's talk about whether or not you believe that North Korea is aiding Syria with a nuclear program.
We have made it clear and will continue to make it clear to the North Koreans through the six-party talks that we expect them to honor their commitment to give up weapons and weapons programs, and to the extent that they are proliferating, we expect them to stop that proliferation if they want the six-party talks to be successful. In other words, whether it be the exportation of information and or materials is an important part. It doesn't matter to us whether they do in terms of the six-party talks because they're both equally important, I guess is the best way to say it. In other words, it does matter whether they, let me rephrase that, it matters whether they are, but the concept of proliferation is equally important as getting rid of programs and weapons.
So you believe they are aiding Syria?
It's a general statement that we expect them not to be proliferating.
President, thousands of people are marching today in Chino, Louisiana, in a racially charged case involving six black students defeating a white student. Also not far from the White House recently, there was a noose that was found hanging from a tree at a college campus. You have worked very hard to bring blacks and Hispanics into your party, but the fallout from the immigration debate and even some Republican presidential candidates' refusal to go to debates at Univision as well as Morgan State calls into question whether or not the state of race relations is deteriorating in this country, and specifically in your party. Your thoughts?
My advice to whoever will be our nominee is to reach out to the African-American community, as well as other communities, because I believe that we've got a very strong record when it comes to empowerment, when it comes to education or home ownership or small business formation. The events in Louisiana have saddened me, and I understand the emotions. The Justice Department and the FBI are monitoring the situation down there, and all of us in America want there to be fairness when it comes to justice. And we've got a good record to run on, and my advice to our candidate would be to run on it.
Do you think this is a defining moment in race relations?
President, Iran's president, Ahmadinejad, says he wants to go to ground zero and place a wreath there. There is some objection to that in New York. What are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that the local police will make the proper decision, and that if they decide for him not to go, like it looks like they have, I can understand why they would not want somebody running a country who's a state sponsor of terror down there at the site. Roger.
Mr. President, back to the economy for a moment. The Fed took its half-point rate cut the other day. Do you think that was enough to stave off recession? And if not, are there other steps you're prepared to do to make sure?
Roger, I do not comment on the decisions made by the Fed. I will comment on Ben Bernanke. I think he's doing a fine job. White House and the Congress are responsible for fiscal policy. The worst decision that Congress could make would be to raise taxes during this period. We don't need to raise taxes in order to fund budget priorities. We have submitted a budget that shows we can get the balance by 2012 without raising taxes. And it's one of the reasons I feel so strongly about, that's why I'm not going to let the taxes be raised.
What do you say to those who criticize you for not speaking out on the situation in Louisiana, particularly given your passionate remarks after Hurricane Katrina was outraged? People say you've fallen silent.
As you know, this is an ongoing trial. There's litigation taking place. I feel strongly that there ought to be fair justice, and I just spoke out on it.
Mr. President, former Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld recently was asked if he missed you. He said no.
Wait a minute. I miss him.
Alan Greenspan has come out with a recent book, criticizing you for being fiscally irresponsible, and they're not the first former government officials to come out and be critical of you. And I'm wondering two things. First, do you feel betrayed by some of these people who have served you and then have come out and criticized you? And then, more particularly, can you respond to Greenspan's criticism?
My feelings are not hurt. You might have been a little selective in quoting Donald Rumsfeld, which I know you didn't mean to be, you know. I respect Secretary Rumsfeld. I believe he did a fine job, and I respect Alan Greenspan. I respectfully disagree with Alan Greenspan when it comes to saying that this administration didn't handle the fiscal issues we faced in good fashion. As a matter of fact, we did. The deficit as a percent of GDP is low. It's lower than 30-year average. We have submitted a plan to balance the budget. We dealt with a recession, a terrorist attack, and corporate scandals. And we did it by cutting taxes. The tax cuts worked. The economy recovered. People are working. Interest rates are low. I'm a supply-sider. I believe supply-side economics, when properly instituted, enables us to achieve certain objectives. One, people finding work and there's hope in the economy. Two, that supply-side economics yields additional tax revenues. And if we're smart about how we manage the fiscal budget, it leads to balance. And that's what we have done. We are fighting a war at the same time that we're headed toward balance. In other words, we're making sure our troops get the money they need and veterans get the benefits they need. Former Chairman Greenspan and I spent a lot of time talking about the unfunded liabilities inherent in Social Security and Medicare. And he's concerned about those unfunded liabilities, as am I, and that's why I went in front of the Congress on more than one occasion talking about how to reform Social Security so that young people who are working aren't paying payroll taxes into a system that's going broke. I'm not going to give up on entitlement reform, but it can require members of both parties to recognize we have a problem that ought to be solved now. I thought it was time to come together a couple of years ago, and there wasn't the political will in Congress. And I'm not so sure we're going to find it now, but I'm going to keep trying because, like the chairman, I understand that the biggest issue we got with the deficit are those deficits inherent in these entitlement programs. John.
Mr. President, there's a deal taking shape this morning where the government of Dubai would buy a share of a stake in the NASDAQ stock market. And there is some concern being expressed on Capitol Hill about this. It's another deal involving people overseas that we might not trust. What's your reaction to it? And also, what's your level of concern about protectionism in general?
Mm-hmm. My reaction is that we have a reform process in place that will be able to deal with this issue. In other words, we're going to take a good look at it as to whether or not it has any national security implications involved in the transaction. And I'm comfortable with the process to go forward. John, I'm also I am concerned about protectionism. I'm concerned about it because if the United States loses its confidence when it comes to trading, it'll make it less likely our economy will grow. And I just told you one of the underpinnings of our support is the fact that exports for Economic Vitality Day is the fact that exports are up and workers benefit when we're selling products overseas. And I believe these free trade agreements will be an interesting test of protectionism, whether protectionism is real. We've got four trade agreements that we've negotiated that we want to get passed. And there's going to be some crucial votes coming up here pretty soon in the Congress. And we'll work hard to get all four trade agreements through. And if they don't get through, it is a sign that the protectionists are beginning to, be on the ascendancy here in Washington, D.C., and that'd be a mistake. And for people who are deeply concerned about poverty around the world like I am, the best way to help lift people out of poverty is through free trade agreements. And that's why we're dedicated to the Doha round that Secretary Schwab is so actively engaged in. Not Secretary Schwab, Trade Negotiator Schwab. And we're committed to reaching an accord with these nations so that because trade helps poor people realize a better life. And it's a proven fact. I'm also worried about isolationism. Isolationism tends to run hand in hand with protectionism. You'll find isolationists are those who say it's not our business what happens overseas. It doesn't matter if there's a free society in the heart of the Middle East as far as our long-term security and peace. I just strongly reject that. I think it does matter a lot that the United States is working with other nations to promote liberty and freedom, because I believe liberty is a change agent. Liberty can help hostile parts of the world become peaceful parts of the world. You know, our strategy in dealing with these extremists who still want to attack us is, on the one hand, chase them and find them and bring them to justice, and on the other hand, help change the conditions that caused 19 kids to get on airplanes and come and kill nearly 3,000 citizens on our soil. The best way to do that is to be active with foreign policy. It's not to lose faith in values, but to actively promote universal values. An isolationist would say it's not worth it. Doesn't matter to the United States of America. Well, I think it does matter, and I think it matters a lot. Herman, have you got a question?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Mr. President, for Republicans seeking election next year, are you an asset or a liability?
Strong asset. Man.
Can I follow?
No. I knew I made a mistake calling on you in the first place.
Oh, he's known you a long time.
Yeah, yes. The problem is I called on him, and I've known him for a long time. Yeah. Look, candidates who go out and say that the United States is vulnerable to attack and we're going to make sure our professionals have the tools necessary to protect us are going to do well. Candidates who go out and say that helping these Iraqis realize the benefits of democracy are going to do well. Candidates who go out and say that it's very important for the United States to have clear principles when it comes to foreign policy, they'll do well. Candidates who say we're not going to raise your taxes will do well.
Quick follow, if I may, Mr. President.
No, you may not.
Mr. President, back to your grade point average on holding the line on taxes.
I thought you were going to talk about the actual grade point average. I remind people that, like when I'm with Condi, I say she's the PhD, and I'm the C student. And just look at who's the president and who's the advisor, but go ahead.
If there is a tax increase on cigarettes to fund the S-CHIPS program, is that a tax increase you oppose?
It does. We don't need to raise taxes. What I want is the Congress to be focused on making sure poor children get the health insurance they were promised. Instead, Congress has made a decision to expand the eligibility up to $80,000. That's not the intent of the program. The program was find poor children and help them with health insurance. Their vision is expand the eligibility so that people making up to 80 will be eligible for this program. I believe this is a step toward federalization of health care. I know that their proposal is beyond the scope of the program, and that's why I'm going to veto the bill. Let's see, Mark.
Mr. President, in January when you announced your troop surge, you said that its goal was to get all 18 Iraqi provinces, the security for those provinces, into Iraqi hands by November of this year. The Pentagon, pardon me, is now telling Congress that's not going to happen until July at the earliest. Have the goalposts shifted once more?
No, the goals are the same. Achieving those goals have been slower than we thought. And the question is, one, whether or not it's worth it to try to achieve the goals. I believe it's worth it for the security of the country. And the reason why I believe it's for the security of the country is that if we were to leave before the job is done, extremist groups like Al-Qaeda would be able to gain safe haven. That's what they said they want. They believe we won't have the will to hang in there and help this Iraqi government succeed, and they want us out. And so the goals of helping Iraqis provide their own security remain the same. And the goals are important toward achieving our objective, and our objective is important for the security of the country. I also believe that a democracy in the heart of the Middle East will be a major blow to extremists or radicals wherever they live in the Middle East. And just yesterday we saw an attack on a anti-Syrian, pro-Lebanese democracy advocate. Now, I don't know who did that, but I do know it is typical of this war we're fighting in, when extremists kill innocent people in order to undermine democracies. And one of the things I feel passionately about is for the United States to recognize what a Middle East would be like if terrorists and extremists were had safe haven and were emboldened by a U.S. defeat. And that's why one, I believe we can succeed, and two, I know we got to succeed. And therefore, have listened carefully to our commanders and our diplomats as to whether or not they think we can succeed, and if so, what do they need to do it? And that's what I talked to the country about. And so, Mark, yeah, the goals are the same. And have we achieved them as fast? No, we haven't. But, however, having not achieved them doesn't mean we ought to quit. It means we ought to work hard to achieve the goals, because the end result is the same, whether the goal is done in November or in July, and that is a country that can govern itself, sustain itself, and defend itself, and is an ally against these extremists and radicals, a country which will deny safe haven to the folks who have sworn allegiance to the crowd that attacked us on September the 11th. A couple of more, and then I'm going to let Levitt come up here. Yeah, please.
Thank you. You said earlier that people in Iraq are sick and tired of the violence. To what extent has the recent Blackwater incident frayed your relations with Prime Minister Maliki and his government? And why are outfits like Blackwater above the law in Iraq?
First of all, I have yet to speak to the Prime Minister about this subject. I'll see him in New York next week at the UN. I'm confident he'll bring it up. I also appreciate the fact that he's willing to work with the U.S. government to set up a commission to find out what actually happened. The folks like Blackwater, who provide security for the State Department, are under rules of engagement. In other words, they have certain rules, and this commission will determine whether or not they violated those rules. And I'm looking forward to finding out what the results are.
About that incident and the fact that...
Well, let's find out what the facts are first. Obviously, to the extent that innocent life was lost, you know, I'm saddened. Our objective is to protect innocent life. And we've got a lot of brave souls in the theater working hard to protect innocent life. And evidently, some innocent lives were lost. And, my thoughts and prayers go out to the families. But I want to find out the facts about exactly what took place there in the theater, and that's exactly what we're about to find out. A couple of more here. Wolf?
Thank you, sir.
You looked asleep back there, so I was calling on you.
You recently spoke just earlier about the importance of oil revenue sharing in Iraq. Recently, a company called Hunt Oil, run by one of your longtime supporters, Ray Hunt, signed a deal with a Kurdish regional government to drill for oil up there. That deal has come under intense criticism from the national government in Baghdad. They say it undermines the discussions about oil legislation. What's your opinion of that kind of deal and how it impacts this long stalled legislation?
Our embassy also expressed concern about it. I knew nothing about the deal. I need to know exactly how it happened. To the extent that it does undermine the ability for the government to come up with a oil revenue sharing plan that unifies the country, obviously, if it undermines that, I'm concerned. Yeah.
Mr. President, thank you.
Big stretch. He's back.
What is your reaction to the MoveOn.org ad that mocked General Petraeus as General Petraeus said that he cooked the books on Iraq? And secondly, would you like to see Democrats, including presidential candidates, repudiate that ad?
I thought the ad was disgusting. And I felt like the ad was an attack not only on General Petraeus, but on the U.S. military. And I was disappointed that not more leaders in the Democrat Party spoke out strongly against that kind of ad. And that leads me to come to this conclusion, that most Democrats are afraid of irritating a left-wing group like MoveOn.org, are more afraid of irritating them than they are of irritating the United States military. That was a sorry deal. And it's one thing to attack me. It's another thing to attack somebody like General Petraeus. All right, Levitt is going to answer some questions if you have any for him. Make sure they're tone them down a little bit. This is his first time in here. Martha, you and Gregory, be polite on it. Thank you for your time, Michael.
Good morning. The President has asked that I respond to any questions that you have with respect to SCHIP. Yes, ma'am.
Yes, well, Congress
was out, the administration directed states to meet several requirements before they could expand the scope of S-CHIP, and one of those was to require children, if their parents had been previously insured, to have to be uninsured for a year before their parents could seek S-CHIP coverage. Why is the administration requiring children to be uninsured a year before they can become insured again?
As the President indicated, he believes, I believe, that S-CHIP was designed for low-income children and for those who currently do not have private insurance. That guidance essentially said this. This is a program for poor children. We think that poor children who do not have insurance ought to go to the head of the line. Those who have private insurance already and those who have high incomes ought to come after. And therefore, we ought to focus our efforts to make certain that we have accomplished that mission. There are many states and many children who currently qualify for S-CHIP who have not been enrolled, and that ought to be our first priority. Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Secretary, the President campaigned on a platform of compassionate conservatism. And I think when he vetoes this bill, as he promises to a lot of Americans, we'll be asking, where's the compassion? How do you respond to that?
The President has made clear that he believes that all Americans ought to have access to an affordable basic insurance policy, that if a person is elderly or if a person is disabled or poor, that's the responsibility of government to help them by providing them with access to insurance and to pay for most of it. S-CHIP is a very important part of that. President would like to see S-CHIP reauthorized, and we'd like to get on to the larger question of how do we provide insurance for all Americans. He made a proposal at the State of the Union. That, ironically, would have, according to the Lewin Group, would have provided insurance to 4.25 million children, and children who currently do not have coverage. The bill that the President will veto is represented to offer 2.6 million insurance. However, 1.2 million of those already have private insurance, and 900,000 of them already qualify. So, we're looking to increase the number of people covered generally and to focus first on getting S-CHIP reauthorized. We'd like to see it reauthorized. We'd like to see it reauthorized before September the 30th. Yes, sir.
Mr. Secretary, there's a lot of discussion about these relatively higher income levels that some states allow families and children to be covered under. But my understanding of the S-CHIP legislation is that it's designed to give states that flexibility, and in fact, those income limits were approved, several of them, by your administration. So why was flexibility a good idea in the initial version of the law, and now you seem to want to steer these states into more of a one-size-fits-all approach? And could you, in commenting on that, could you comment on the fact that healthcare costs are indeed higher in many places than they are some other places?
First, let me remind everyone that S-CHIP was designed as a program to provide coverage for children under 200%. What we now know is that children who are in the 200 to 300% of the poverty line, that 75% of them have coverage, that those who are 300 to 400%, that 90% have private coverage. But there are still those who are under 200% who do not. And so our effort has been to focus on those who have under 200% and lay out guidelines to say before we start going to those who are in 300 to 400% of the poverty line and moving them from private insurance to government insurance, let's focus on those who are poor. This is a program for low-income children. We still have many to reach, and that needs to be our first objective.
Following up, what about if states, could you address the flexibility question? If states choose to have different rules to cover different populations, why shouldn't that be allowed?
Well, the guidance allows them to do that. It says that essentially you need to put poor children at the front of the line, and once you've accomplished that mission, if you have money left in your allotment, then you're free to cover them at levels that you would choose. That's according to our guidance.
People like Senator Grassley and everything are not been keen toward the White House position on this bill. Do you have the votes to sustain a veto?
Yes. We believe that the Congress, the leadership of the House, has been very clear that they would are prepared to stand with the President.
Is a veto inevitable?
Well, the President has said himself that at least the bill that we sense is coming from the conference or the combination of the House and Senate has some very serious problems. It helps those who are well off as opposed to those who are poor. It moves people from private insurance to government insurance. It covers adults. This is a program for children. It's funded with some budget gimmicks. It funds the first period of time and then goes from about $16 billion a year, and then the next year it drops to $3 billion. Well, they've done that to be able to meet a budget target, but clearly that means that they would have to either increase taxes or cut other places. And there's a better alternative. I mean, our message is very clear. We would like to have every American have access to an affordable policy. SCHIP is an important part of that. It needs to be reauthorized. Now, the President has given me the assignment today to work with states to assure that we minimize any dilemmas that could come from Congress not acting. We'll be doing that. We believe that we can accomplish it, but not forever. And so the Congress does need to act.
Can I clarify something you said, please?
Yes.
A moment ago, you said that the President would like to develop a plan that covers everyone, but then you also said the President would like to have a proposal that would increase accessibility to everyone. It was reported a few days ago that you told an editorial board that the President would like to work with Congress basically to cover everyone, and doesn't that mean universal health care coverage?
What the President has said, and what I said to the editorial board, is that the President would like to see everyone have access to an affordable basic insurance policy. SCHIP is an important part of that. He has made proposals that, in fact, independent evaluators have said that it would cover 16 million Americans. There are bills that have been filed in Congress that use a series of tools that would cover as many as 21 million. If either of those would pass, we would see 4 to 5 million children covered in that context. The President would like us to get SCHIP reauthorized and then move on to the larger discussion about how we get every American access to an affordable basic policy.
The President used the term today, a clean temporary extension of SCHIP. What does that mean in your view? What is the temporary part of this?
Well, it seems likely that Congress will not be able to achieve reauthorization by September the 30th. And therefore, so that we have no continuity problems, so as he put it, the coverage doesn't lapse for children, he would like Congress to temporarily extend the existing program so as to achieve continuity of coverage.
Is that specifically Chairman Barton's idea? Is that the Joe Barton amendment?
Mr. Barton has, as I understand, is going to file legislation that would extend it for some period of time. I think what the President has said is that we need to extend it for a suitable period of time that we can work these differences
out. And current funding levels or increased funding levels?
Well, we need to extend it. It would depend on the length of time that they want to extend it. If they're prepared to extend it for a period of 6 months or 12 months, we'd obviously have to talk about additional funding because there would be needs. If it's a short term, then there is a narrow window here where we could I think, minimize the amount of disruption. However, this needs to be reauthorized. There will be a problem if we don't get it reauthorized.
What is you mentioned, or the President mentioned, some kind of mitigation that you would try to work out with the states. What is that all about?
Let me explain that SCHIP is a program that has allocations of money to states. Each state has an allocation, and they have to meet the requirements of their state legislature within that allocation. Most states have money still in their allocation that they can continue to spend after the program has the authorization for additional funding has lapsed. There are 12 states that we have concern may not have substantial enough money to do that over a long period of time, and so the President has asked that I go that I meet with each of the states and that we make certain that they have a plan in place to minimize the disruption that would come from Congress not acting.
Is there any way you can get other money for the states that don't have much money? Is there any way to get more money to them with short of an extension?
The only way to do it after the authorization for us to spend money has lapsed would be to have a temporary extension, and that's what the president is asking for.
Do you have a list of those 12 states? Do you know them all?
I don't have them here, but I'm sure they can be provided. And actually, I think we're still working to assemble that list. I mean, we're working with each state, so it's likely we won't release the list until we've had a chance to meet with each state and determine just where they are.
If Congress went along with the president's proposal and increased funding by $5 billion, my understanding is that just keeps the chip where it is now. I talked to Senator Orrin Hatch, who's been really active with this, and he said that's not enough, that the current program doesn't reach all of the people who are uninsured, even the children. If the president wants everyone to have access to an affordable health care plan, and there are children not being reached by the current program, why doesn't the administration want some other increase in funding, somewhere between $5 billion and the $35 billion being talked about?
There are two questions here. One is a math problem, and the other is a question of ideology. With respect to the math problem, what number is required in order to fund those who would be covered by the existing program? It's important to state exactly what our proposal is. We desire to see SCHIP continue to cover those children who are under 200% of the poverty line. We believe that the $5 billion is adequate to do that. If it isn't, then we're prepared to talk about what the number should be, but it's the policy, the ideologic question that we want to focus on, because we think the bill that they're going to send it goes in an entirely different direction. It moves toward a system where the government runs and owns the system. The president supports proposals that would allow the government to organize the system, where everyone could have access to an affordable basic policy, where the government does help those children who have low incomes, where we're not moving people from private insurance onto government insurance. That's the ideologic disagreement. I feel confident that if we resolve that, that the issue with respect to the numbers will work itself out.
Could you do one more? There's one.
Could you clarify, please, if a state now covers more than 200% of poverty, what does the administration want to see? Does it want it not to cover those people, roll back to 200, or does it want to say, you know, you have to make sure that 95% of the 200 are covered?
We believe this is a program that was designed to cover those who are under or 200% and under. There are states who have chosen to go above that. We have offered guidance that if you choose to do that with your allotment, then given the fact that we pay for 70% of it, meaning the federal government, we would like you to put poor children at the head of the line, as opposed to bringing in people who already have coverage and putting them in front of poor children. So it's very clear, very simple guidance. Put poor children first before you bring people who are already insured in the private market. The guidance was necessary because the current law allows states to define what income is. It allows them, it does not create a standard, and that's the appropriate place where guidance needs to be offered, where the law frames in a particular area but does not offer guidance in framing up the detail. Thank you.